It's all the files of the whole park. It tells you everything.
Sir, he's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
You know, if you haven't heard, in the last few years, there's been a lot of discussion around America's problems with systemic white supremacism and, well, white nationalists.
We predicted that Charlottesville would be the largest gathering of white supremacists in over a decade. And unfortunately, we were right.
Jews will not replace us! Jews will not!
Everybody remembers that day in Charlottesville and the problems with the far right we've seen since, especially during this 2020 election season. In her new book, Culture Warlords, journalist Talia Lavin goes undercover to expose the underworld of online fascists, Nazis, and Trump trolls alike. She's on cyber to tell us more. I'm Ben Maku, and enjoy the show. Well, Talia, thanks very much for coming on the show. Appreciate it. This book is great. It's very timely.
Thank you. I agree. One of the greatest works of Western literature, personally, in my unbiased opinion. No, I don't know. It just came out today. Most people haven't read it, so I can say that.
And it's, I mean, you couldn't have asked for a crazier storm surrounding this type of book. I mean, between Trump shouting out Proud Boys to some militia activity that happened last week, this book is very of the moment.
Unfortunately, I mean, I really wish that it was as quaint as like if I had written a book about honeycombs or soup, but like, you know, I was sort of driven to it by what I felt was the urgency of the topic. And unfortunately, that's really been borne out by the news.
So explain to me, how did you come about writing Culture Warlords?
So it kind of actually started because I was routinely a target of far-right extremists and like the far-right media. It was sort of like the abyss was already gazing into me. So I thought I would gaze back and double down and sort of make that gaze as penetrating as I could. You know, I'd already been featured on the Daily Stormer, the Nazi site, a couple of times as, you know, the K word of the hour, and regularly got anti-Semitic death, rape threats. So I thought, you know, okay, you have come to me and I will examine you.
Well, that's the thing, is that you are a Jewish journalist who is going into these, you know, very crazy Nazi, white supremacist, alt-right doldrums, and you sock puppets to penetrate these groups. And what was that like? Like, I mean, how did you get in? And then also, how were you able to sort of convince them that you were one of them?
Well, I do want to start by saying the intention wasn't necessarily to write a gonzo book from the beginning. I did try to go through the front door and talk to some folks who represented these organizations. Unfortunately, my reputation as sort of a Jewish anti-fascist loudmouth sort of preceded me. And I was specifically barred from a number of groups. And so I had to kind of go in the back way. And as to where I found the spaces I entered, I mean, I had worked for Media Matters as an extremism researcher as my prior job. And so based on what I did for that job, which was basically surveil the far right landscape every day and produce an internal newsletter, kind of being like, here's what the far right's talking about today, I had a pretty good idea of the landscape. In 2019, when I was doing the bulk of the reporting, a lot of Nazis, like there had been some sort of pro forma bannings of large Nazi accounts from Twitter and Facebook. So they were starting to try to figure out where to migrate to. And I noticed that on 8chan, there were people starting to link to this encrypted app, Telegram, and listing channels where they were gathering with lovely names like Holocaust 2 and Generation Zyklon and, you know, all sorts of variations of the N-word. And so I started joining those chats under a false name. And then they linked to each other's content. There were separate channels that listed far-right channels to join. And so I wound up joining around 90 chats and surveilling them on a daily basis, as well as kind of looking at the broader landscape online and on YouTube and everywhere that I could find. But the bulk, a lot of my research took place on Telegram, which really became a locus of far-right organizing in 2019.
And so, you know, for the average listener that doesn't know a lot about the far right, I mean, I'm a far right reporter. I do a lot in this space, but I think you really broke down how pervasive the online world is and how much of a culture it is of itself. What did you find in this gonzo journey?
Nothing particularly good, Ben. No, I mean, I think the goal of the book is really to break it down for the layman reader, like who hasn't, like us, spent, you know, a significant portion of our adult lives like marinating in poison. What I found, it is interesting to the degree to which it is a self-contained culture with these reference points, these slogans, these sort of code words that are sort of shorthand for broader concerns, like, you know, this idea of white genocide, that like through demographic change and immigration, the white race is being turned into a persecuted minority. You know, one of the shorthands that sort of haunts me and was the like name of several chats was Make America 110. So there's this really specious statistic. I actually looked at a breakdown of it. It was just totally false, but it's this idea that Jews have been kicked out of 109 countries and they want to make America the 110th and make it Judenrein. So, you know, that was a concept that I encountered. You know, there's a lot of exchanging of texts, you know, Mein Kampf and the Turner Diaries, stuff you might expect, but also phrenological texts from the 19th century and, you know,
Siege
by James Mason, the convicted pedophile / spiritual godfather of the Ottenboffen division, stuff like that. Yeah, read Siege. I mean, they really do encourage each other to read and use like the very unfortunately sturdy edifice of racist texts and eugenic texts that have come out of the West in the last 200 years and use that as a scaffolding of proof, you know, from eugenics to phrenology, all kinds of pseudoscience, as well as, you know, the sort of myth of the white Western man under attack that's, you know, propped up in various ways from religion to these sweeping narratives that they create and trade among themselves. I mean, it's a world of sort of self-reinforcing propaganda and stochastic terror that just iterates and iterates and iterates in these spaces of radicalization.
And I think it's really interesting and it's an important thing to note, because I think a lot of people, when I'm reporting on this type of thing, and it's tough for people to realize that these types of worlds, it's like QAnon, for example. You know, they have literature to support the culture, and this becomes a culture and it's a worldview. And they take these people really do take on these very illogical worldviews. And you can kind of see it in the way that they, like you said, they have book clubs.
Yeah, they make audiobooks for one another. I mean, it is like QAnon, maybe. I mean, the people I studied were like more like a little bit contemptuous of QAnon just because it's so boomery. They tended to be a bit younger and sort of, QAnon is all about this sort of wide-eyed belief, you know, like very, like these elastic minds willing to accommodate every conspiracy theory that sounds shiny within the broader sort of frame of Trump is going to save us from the Satanist pedophiles. But like the people that I studied tended to be younger and more cynical. And while they were very emphatically dedicated to the preservation of the white race, there's a lot of nihilistic cynicism there too. So yeah, it is like QAnon in the sort of elaborateness of the worldview and the carapace that gets built to sort of accommodate it and also insulate it against, you know, people who would dare to assert such things as Nazism is bad. But it is a little bit, it does differ from QAnon a bit, like the specific sort of online white power movement that I was looking at.
Did you ever find that, because obviously the moment that we're in right now, at least in the last, I'd say probably since the founding of Iron March in 2015, which is, you know, in shorthand, it's a sort of Nazi Facebook, Twitter / encrypted messaging group that spawned a lot of these whole ideologies and groups. Did you ever find that there was something about right now and this moment that is producing this type of thinking?
Well, I think Trump is a big part of it. I mean, he's the elephant in the room in a sense. I think his sort of open white nationalism in the 2015-2016 campaign season and then subsequent victory against all odds or whatever was really a huge shot in the arm to this movement that really can't be overstated. I mean, there were all these triumphant headlines. There was widespread rejoicing and these sort of swampy corners of the internet that were rife with racial slurs. And then subsequently, you know, once these groups form, they harden around different ideology, you know, they harden around different aspects of the ideology. I'd say right now is an interesting and precarious moment because, you know, you have people who are part of the MAGA movement. Chris Mathias, who's a reporter at the Huffington Post that is great, or HuffPost that is great, sort of laid out his thesis that, you know, the violence he's seen comes from sort of mainstream MAGA folks. You know, that a lot of the violence planned, for example, the Whitmer kidnapping plot, that was so horrifying. Like, these were sort of Trump supporters, mainline Trump supporters. The people that I surveilled, like, certainly hideous violence has come out of that community, including the Christchurch mosque shooting, including the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, the El Paso Walmart massacre. I mean, they are capable of violence. And we're at this particular moment where they're sort of disillusioned with Trump. They put a lot of hope in him and then found that despite his grotesque racism, there were elements of his governance that were simply too establishmentarian conservative for them. And that he was too cozy with Jews. Like, you know, he had Jews in his administration. He has a Jewish son-in-law. He had allowed his white daughter to be corrupted by the Jews. And so there's a move away from electoralism, you know, and attempting to infiltrate the GOP as like straightforward white nationalists without covering or apologizing for it or even being covert. There's a move away from that and towards accelerationism, which is the sort of thesis that, in this case, that civilizational collapse and the collapse of the U.S. government will facilitate the creation of a white utopia and will allow them to engage in the sort of ethnic cleansing that is the linchpin of their fantasies, you know, that they'll be able to be the Einsatzgruppen they've always wanted to be.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. So that's a very dangerous philosophy to have coursing through the minds of a lot of, you know, young men who are also obsessed with weapons, you know.
Incredibly dangerous. Mm. And I mean, I think right now, one thing you are seeing is that the FBI, for example, is very wary of this. And then I think to some degree, you're seeing them see this as a threat in a way that they almost never really have.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, you know, as others have pointed out in this space, you know, when it comes to white supremacists engaging in terror against, you know, say protesters, when you've seen the like phenomenally like enormous amount, you know, of attacks against protesters, you know, who've been part of the George Floyd Black Lives Matter movement over the past 3 months. There's been almost no federal intervention whatsoever, and just straightforward sympathy from local law enforcement. Mm-hmm. You know, the FBI gets involved when they feel there might be a threat to the state. But, you know, it's not as if this is necessarily about justice. It's about order. you know, so we've seen, you know, I think there have been 22 incidents of gun violence and shootings at protests, almost 500 incidents of car attacks on protesters. I mean, really extraordinary numbers, far-right violence in ways that are sort of unanticipated, incredibly widespread cross-country, and yet sort of slipped under the radar and certainly haven't culminated in the kind of showy law enforcement stuff that we saw in Michigan. So, you know, I do question the premise that this is about protecting people. I think it is about protecting the structures of power.
So to that point, at what point do you think that, or to what degree do you think tech companies and some of the platforms that these groups have traditionally used are responsible for the growth of some of these movements?
I think they are collaborators. I mean, I think they're just responsible on every level. I really cannot underscore my contempt for the way tech companies have dealt with this issue from the start. And there are certainly, you know, Black women were some of the first people sounding the alarms, like women like Sadette Harry and Lanasa Crockett, who, you know, were sort of saying from the first, from 2012, 13, you know, saying like, hey, there are people from 4chan and 8chan who are masquerading as Black men and women to sow dissension. So all this stuff, you know, that got chalked up to Russian interference later, or like became more mainstream as an issue when, you know, white reporters like us started looking into it, like there were people who were sounding the alarm much earlier. So I just want to get that out. But as to the responsibility of tech companies in the first place, I mean, one of the points I make in the book, and this is more amply documented by the wonderful Kathleen Ballou in her book, Bring the War Home, is that the Klan were among the earliest adopters of the internet. I mean, back in the DARPA days, back in the early 80s, they had created websites for recruitment that they could use for anonymity and planning. You know, they were early and enthusiastic adopters of the internet. So it's not as if people creating social media sites could not have, with the most cursory examination of history, anticipated this problem. But instead, they neglected to do so with this move fast and break things ethos. And unfortunately, a lot of the what's been broken along the way is people's lives, people's sense of safety. You know, there's the superficial, stupid conversation about cancel culture, but I can tell you that I've censored myself, and so many other people have been censored and driven offline by racial slurs, by the most crude misogynistic harassment. And it happens every day. And that, you know, never gets brought up as an issue. So I think, you know, if tech companies invested a fraction of what should be invested in content moderation, as they do in UI or other aspects of, you know, their empires, then we might be living in a completely different landscape, and one in which white supremacy was not flourishing so violently online. I mean, I think tech companies operate in this way in which they've outsourced the responsibility of checking violent organizing to a diminishing and depleted press corps. They only act reactively and in a way that sort of minimally covers their asses. And we live in a moment of crisis. Of course, I'm not expecting techno-plutocrats to save us, but neither will I absolve them of their role.
Well, I think it's just, you look at the influence of something like Facebook to the Boogaloo movement, and you can see also Facebook's hesitance to crack down on it properly. It took basically the summer for them to really start to make moves on it. And then, you know, meanwhile, you have all this online organizing happening on these platforms, and it's, you know, I think it's, when you look at something like Telegram, you know they're not going to do anything, but then you have these larger American companies that clearly can be subject to shareholders, et cetera, and they're not doing much.
No, they're doing less than nothing. I mean, I'm working on a project on militias right now, and I can tell you militia organizing is alive and thriving on Facebook, regardless of what their press shop would like you to believe. You know, Boogaloo organizing still exists on Facebook. Like, it is all still happening there. you know, these groups haven't even been driven underground. They're like, Facebook just like suspends a couple hundred pages, sends out a press release, and, you know, a lot of credulous journalists in the tech space will, you know, duly repeat that, you know, press release and call it a day. And then, you know, Facebook can pat itself on the back. And meanwhile, people are going to die. I mean, you saw it in Kenosha, where you had this event that directly led to the deaths of two protesters that had been reported, and nothing happened. You know, I have tried to report death threats, rape threats against me. Nothing happens. You know, content moderation should be at a premium. And we've seen over and over and over again that it's outsourced. There's no mental health support for the people who do this kind of thing. You know, it's for pennies on the dollar. It's really not a priority. And that's insane to me. I mean, it just speaks to such a contempt for their users. You know, we know already that we're cattle being sold for data, but, you know, it would be nice at least to be fed some good grain and have the poison taken out of it.
And not to mention, I mean, it's pretty rich when, you know, people like yourself and journalists and people of color and trans people have received endless death threats on platforms like Twitter. And yet when people make jokes about President Trump dying of COVID-19, it's become an issue. And then the company takes action.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, who is being protected? And it's always the people in power. It's like always about preserving power and wealth. And like, these are the motivations here. That's not a question to me. I mean, the path towards making these places online better, juster, healthier, and less beset by extraordinary white nationalism and the recruitment of people towards white supremacist terror is open. It's laid out. Like, there's so many experts who have so clearly been ringing this warning bell and offering solutions. And yet, you know, the tech companies are interested in profit. They're interested in selling our data to the cops. And, you know, they could not telegraph the fullness of their contempt more richly and fully. And so, you know, I really think if you're looking for someone to offer absolution to the tech companies, I am not that person.
Well, thanks a lot, Tali, for being on the show. I appreciate it. And everyone should go out and read Culture Warlords.
Yeah. You know, greatest work in Western literature. Move over Herman Melville. And found quaking in his grave. No, but it's, I worked really hard on it. I exposed myself to some truly horrendous stuff so that you wouldn't have to. And, it's available on audiobook and Kindle and Amazon and your local bookstore. So please do go give it a read if you can. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thanks so much.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, hello, Ben. How are you?
Lorenzo. Okay. Let's get right into this cipher. So cipher John McAfee, one of the weirdest, like, most villainous characters in big tech ever, possibly. I mean, the guy, like, probably killed some people or someone, allegedly, in Belize.
Yeah, most likely. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. He also was kind of a pioneer in creating one of the first social networks.
Yeah, this is like, when I saw this, I was like, holy shit, that's crazy. But also kind of makes sense because, you know, as you said, John McAfee is truly bad and evil. And, you know, we are not celebrating him at all here. It's just like a this is just a great example that, like, you know, bad people in tech were doing interesting things for a long time. And this is a great example of that. You know, this is the early 90s, I think. So, you know, early days of the web. And he had the great idea of creating some sort of a chat social media, you know, a hybrid of a chat app and social media when this was really not something that people were doing. And, you know, as much as John McAfee, as we said, is a really bad person, he was definitely a person that, especially back then, had a good eye for business. You know, the McAfee antivirus is still called McAfee because he had the eye of, you know, starting an antivirus business when it wasn't really that popular of an idea. So, yeah, this is a great story. I think it's a classic Ernie Smith story. You know, he's great at going back into the archives and pulling out amazing forgotten or overlooked stories. Definitely worth a read.
Definitely. And I should add, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I spent, I think, 7 hours with John McAfee in 2013.
Yeah, I kind of don't want to ask you what you guys did. It's almost like it's better.
It was when I was working for a wire in Canada. Oh, wow. It was like a totally journalistic thing, just to be clear. And it was very weird. I got to tell you,
nobody was killed in those 7 hours. That's
not that I know of, but it was in Montreal, and he was just an erratic character. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, and just to close the circle on him, jokes apart, like, you know, what happened in Belize is still very much unclear. But there's a great Netflix documentary about it, and, you know, it doesn't leave a lot of doubts. At least that he's a sexist and probably a murderer. And right now,
anyway, let's go on. Let's go on before this goes into libelous territory. Yeah, anyway, so Lorenzo, geez, give him this guy.
We gotta give the lawyers something to do too. You know, they're bored.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I don't think they're bored at all.
Shout outs to Yoni.
The goal of Iran's fake problem, this is one of yours, emails was chaos. I just want to be clear. I did call this, didn't I?
You did call it. Did you say it was Iran? I think you said, yes,
I said
actually.
Russia or Iran. I said Russia or Iran, yeah.
Yes, yes, you did call it. And in fact, you not only you called it in that sense, you also had the foresight to say that this reminded you of the cyber caliphate, which was one of the most famous false flags that we've seen and proven, and people have proven in the last few years. So yeah, just to set up the stage, as you know, probably everyone knows, last week, thousands of voters across the US started to receive threatening emails saying vote for Trump or else. And yeah, it turns, and the emails were pretending to be from the Proud Boys, you know, this neo-Nazi group that you and others advise have covered really well in the last few months. But yeah, fast forward to only 3 days later, and the US government was like, well, actually, no, it wasn't the Proud Boys, it was Iran, which was a great example that when governments want, they can do attribution very quickly. And you know, we have no evidence yet behind this claim. Reuters reported that the mistake that the Iranian hackers did was include an IP address in the video that we,
of course,
wrote about.
Of course.
And, you know, first of all, that those kind of mistakes happen even to the best of us, even to the best Russian hackers, even to the best Chinese hackers. It can happen. And so
yeah, it's pretty sloppy.
It's pretty sloppy.
Honest.
Yeah. Let's you know, the NSA does not do that. Let's put
I was gonna
it
say
way.
The NSA doesn't get caught doing this.
Yeah, the NSA doesn't.
Just to tie this one off though, the one thing I did find funny about, and the reason I spotted it, and I remember I slacked you on this. I was like, this is like totally mm-hmm. some bullshit from
Yeah, that was
Iran,
awesome.
Russia.
Like you really totally called it.
And to be honest with you, the reason I thought of it that way because it reminded me of how shitty that first one was. Mm-hmm. It's just such a shit.
Yeah.
It shows that these people whoever did this has almost zero understanding of American culture.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost like it's got like a parodied version of what they think American culture, like this wouldn't get found out. And yeah. And that's like the Proud Boys are going to come to your house and fuck you up. Like, listen, I'm not going to defend the Proud Boys and that's such a terrible place to be, but like, they're not going to do that.
You know?
Yeah, like, yeah.
I'm sorry.
I think it was pretty sloppy overall, but like it got some impact, and maybe that's all they wanted. You know, I think the person probably that came up with this, that who had this idea, is gonna get a raise because this had.
I don't know, because it's also like it raises the specter against Iran, and at a time when, like, you know, Biden wins, they're gonna come back and be like, "What the fuck, man?" And well, Iran's like under crushing sanctions; they really can't afford to have any more.
Yeah, maybe.
So I don't know. I'm not convinced this is a smart move. Period. I think it's. It would be smart if it actually worked and someone, like, I don't know, like from the perspective of an aggressor state to the United States, like someone burns down a voting poll or something like that.
Yeah, I think time will tell.
Yeah. Anyway, so this next one, this is a viral hit from Matthew Galt, friend of the show.
And
Matthew Galt.
Great job. He's been doing a great job.
He has. He's been killing it. He had this amazing story about, and it's such a, honestly, this is a question that I've been fielding from people constantly. Keep asking me, like, what do you think's going on with America right now? Is a civil war coming? And this one is the US already in a civil war? Now, I love the reporting on this. It's sort of a look at, like, experts who've weighed through data points other civil wars in the past few years and how they kind of, you know, they calibrate to things like Syria and some of the unrest that happened before the war actually happened. And actually looking at, sort of comparing that to some of the unrest that's been happening in the United States. And I think it is very similar. I'm going to be honest with you. Like, from my perspective, it's not, this is why the recent, you know, the last summer and the unrest that's come from, especially the far right and you know, the protests, it is like, it's unprecedented, at least unprecedented in the last 30 years.
Yeah, I think this story is a sobering reminder that history does not happen exactly in the way we study in the books, you know? And this is not to say that the history books are not accurate. What I'm saying is that it's very hard to know. It's very hard to, like, study, you know, the American Civil War or World War II, the lead up to it, and sort of, and not really understand how that looks like on the ground day to day.
Exactly.
So the central argument of the story is that it may be already happening and we just don't know because, as Galt wrote, collapse is not evenly distributed. And maybe what we're seeing are symptoms of a collapse that's already ongoing and a civil war that's brimming in the background.
Exactly. So I think, you know, to finalize this episode on a fantastic note, it's kind of, you know... Two things, because I'm reporting on the far right constantly and on these, like, paramilitary neo-Nazi groups. Two things, you know, the stuff that happened in Portland with the Michael Reinl killing and the it really was a tit for tat killing. And that's what I thought. I thought to myself, we're at the point in American history where we got tit for tat politicized killings between rival death squads almost. And I laugh only because I'm just, like, so uncomfortable with this notion. And I remember that made me very uncomfortable, but it also reminded me of something else because I've reported really extensively on the war in Ukraine. And one of the most interesting things about the war in Ukraine, if you're American or Canadian and you're there, is the landscape itself, while it's, you know, in the former Soviet Union and it's in Ukraine and it's not Canada, it's not the United States of America, it looks pretty similar.
Hmm.
And when you look at it, it's destroyed and it's what the post-Civil War state would look like in the US or Canada. I remember always thinking that way. And the one thing I always remember hearing from people there was nobody thought that it was going to happen there.
Yeah.
I remember I was hiding out in a bombed out house, and there was, no joke, the dry cleaning of, I guess, dad's dry cleaning literally on the bed that was rushed out of. And this is 2 years later. And I remember thinking the guy was so didn't think that his area of the world was going to go to war that he did his dry cleaning.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show you a lot. Who knows? I don't think there's a imminent military conflict, but what I am saying is I think we need to have respect that these sorts of bad things can happen, and we need to do everything we can to
and we have to pay attention and be careful and
exactly,
you know, go to vote, be active in politics, because this may very well be the most important time in American modern history.
This might be the only time I've ever actually believed, I've actually agreed that this is the most important election.
Mm. Yeah.
In the past, I'm like, come on.
That's yeah, that's a cliche, but this year.
Yeah, this one, I'm like, true. I don't know. It feels much different. But anyway.
Yeah.
All right, Lorenzo, I'll talk to you later. Go. Thanks, Forza, Forza Juve. Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.